when I first entered the army, I was given a book called How the Army Runs. It's this big tome, probably like a 10-pound book, you know, 1,000 pages of just how the army works. I mean, if you thought that Hegel was full of, you know, distinctions and things, I mean, the interlocking organizational and decision-making structures in the army, even though they're built around sort of principles, but there are these elaborate internal processes that go on in order to produce this end product, which is the budget that goes to Congress. So I think that there is something philosophical about that, about understanding interacting structures.
Welcome to another episode of Wisdom at Work, Philosophy Beyond the Ivory Tower, where I interview people who translate philosophy into successful careers beyond the academy. So we're back from a little August recess, I've been liking to call it, of about a month's break between episodes. So I'm happy to be back in the saddle. My guest today is Cameron Keyes. Cameron is the last of the trio of graduates from a very special program at ASU you may have already heard about from my previous guests, Zach Pirtle and Marcy Baranski. Cameron also followed the path of the Presidential Management Fellow, in his case, into the Department of Defense. In this episode, he walks us through how he came to work for what is actually the largest organization in the world, the Department of Defense, and how he went from a background in philosophy and policy and science and technology studies to working on analyzing R&D budgets for the Army. And I found this episode interesting because I think a lot of us asked about, you know, military spending. I think there's a lot of mystery surrounding the budgeting process in the Army. Cameron has a very eclectic intellectual and academic and professional background. He's done unconventional work, we might call it the intersection of science, policy, and philosophy. He tells us about his experience doing laboratory ethnography. What is that? You'll find out in this episode. He talks about some work he's done on nanotechnology, on synthetic biology. We talk about Buddhism. We talk about baseball. And we also talk about his brief experience working as a production assistant on the movie Tropic Thunder when he was in Hawaii and got to hang out with Ben Stiller's driver. So I think Cameron is another good example of a success story of somebody with a philosophical background, philosophically inclined, working his way into the federal government. And I should also say that Cameron and I recorded this almost a couple years ago. We actually decided to do a follow-up episode. Now, since then, Cameron has moved on to bigger and better things, gotten a couple more degrees, a lot more professional experience. So we'll be getting to that next week, so stay tuned for that. Special thanks to the sponsorship of the APA through their Barry Fund for Public Philosophy. Please enjoy my conversation with Cameron Keyes. Cameron, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, David. I'm glad to be here.
And home is Washington, D.C., correct?
I'm in Washington, D.C., yes, in Northwest Washington, D.C., close to Howard University.
I'm sure we'll be getting to what it's like being in the belly of the beast in Washington these last couple of years later when we get to your work at the Department of Defense. But I wanted to start, for listeners, I had asked Cameron, you know, kind of what are some of his hobbies and, you know, interests outside of work and philosophy and so on. And you mentioned that you are a competitive woodbat baseball player. How competitive is competitive?
Well, I've been playing baseball for most of my life, and when I finished college, I took a 12-year hiatus because I didn't know that there was a whole world of sort of amateur competitive baseball out there. And so when I got to D.C., I heard about some local leagues, and the league that I play in is called the Federal Baseball League. It's based out of here in the, you know, Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C., Southern Maryland area. Mm-hmm. And many of the kids that play in this league have a background of playing in college, so Division III, Division II former players, mm-hmm, that have decided that they want to keep playing. But it's not.
And you played in college? competitively?
I played some club baseball in college, but I did not play all the way through in college. So the competition, the skill level is very good. I'm one of the oldest guys in the league, so it's the fun thing about it is that we don't have to practice all week. We get to show up for the games, have a good time, so it's not so competitive that you really have to master the preparation for it. You just go out there and kind of wing it, and it's been a lot of fun. I've been doing it for 3 years now.
So is it about 3 years that you've been in Washington?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay. I've been here. I think I moved actually in December of 2014 and for the job search, because I decided it was best to be on the ground in D.C. if I was going to be looking for a job in D.C. So I came out here then and started playing ball in that spring, that following spring, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard that's pretty common for people who are looking for jobs in government, that like you just got to move there and then kind of pound the pavement until you land something. So you came without having a job lined up.
Well, I had a fellowship that we'll get a chance to talk about, this presidential management fellowship, and I became a finalist for this fellowship. And between the time that you become a finalist and the time that you actually get a job, you have a one-year window where nothing is really guaranteed. You've become a finalist, but you still have to find a placement in one of the agencies. And so I did some phone interviews and came out to Washington for another interview. And the sense that I got was that if I really wanted to do some targeted job searching and be available for sort of spontaneous opportunities, that I had to be here in D.C. So I came here in the winter, and it wasn't until February, so for about 3 months, where I was kind of in limbo, without a job, searching for things to do. And I interned on the Hill briefly, and just to keep things going with the resume and get a sense of momentum. And then finally, I got the interview that I was looking for and started work. So, yeah, it was a harrowing 3 months, but I think it was best that I was here to do it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, we can get to this in more detail, but I love, one of the things that I've loved interviewing people is hearing their sort of time in the wilderness stories, you know, where they don't know what is going to happen, whether things are going to work out, and then they find their first opportunity. So we can come back to that in a little bit. But to give listeners a brief sense, rough sense for what you do, when people ask you, what do you do, how do you typically respond?
I analyze research and development budgets for the Department of Defense, specifically for the Army Budget Office. So that, in a nutshell, is what I do. What that actually involves is my specific office prepares the president's budget, the portion of the president's budget that is research, development, test, and evaluation. So I'm partly responsible for a piece of the defense and technology piece and some of the test and evaluation. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of financial management analysis. I do a lot of stakeholder engagement with different offices within the Department of Defense, and we answer questions from Congress when they have questions about what the budget needs to look like. And so on a daily basis, yeah, it's analyzing research and development budgets in several different ways.
I imagine that would be very gratifying to actually have some idea what is going on, what all the money is going toward, because I imagine if you would ask the average person on the street what they think about, you know, military spending, of course it would depend on, you know, probably to some extent their political orientation, but I think for a lot of people they would say, well, we spend too much on the military. What could all that money be going to? So I imagine, have you found some gratification in having, you know, clear answers to those questions?
You know, one of the interesting things about digging into the minutiae of a budget like that is I'm not so sure that the deeper you go, the clearer everything gets. Because there's so many interlocking decision processes in the Department of Defense, and because the sort of ecosystem of businesses that the DoD interfaces with is so vast, I'm not sure that 3 years in my case is enough to sort of be able to wrap my head around big patterns of spending. But I certainly sympathize with the search for more efficient ways to save money so that it can be spent on things that are as important or more important, for sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. So yeah, we can get more into the details of your work and how you came to work on these subjects in the first place. But why don't we go backwards and get a sense for how you grew up? Where did you grow up originally?
I was born in Ohio. So I grew up my early years in Dayton, Ohio. And then my family moved to Cleveland, to a suburb of Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And I was raised in a suburb of Cleveland until I was 18. And then I went to college in southeastern Ohio at Ohio University for a few years. And so, yeah, I'm Ohio, born and raised.
And how would you describe your intellectual awakening? Was that an interest in philosophy? Was it a great teacher? Was it a particular book that really sparked your interest?
I think it was several of those things. Yeah. When I was in high school, a combination of things happened to me. One was that my English teacher referred me to the advanced placement program, and I started getting exposed to Shakespeare and several really good books. And something about reading literature really made me think about big questions about culture and identity and relationships. And from that, I also was in that class with some friends, and so I had a lot of really good friends that were also interested in everything from music and theater to, philosophy. Mm-hmm. And so I started reading philosophy books in a small group of friends as a complement to, new experiences in music and mm-hmm. new experiences in other art forms.
So that's a pretty early introduction to philosophy already in high school.
Yeah, so my first book that had a kind of specifically philosophical bent, we had to read Albert Camus' The Stranger for our AP English class. I remember from that, someone recommended that I read Dostoevsky's Underground Man,
mm-hmm.
Notes from Underground.
Yep, yep.
And those first books that I read were very sort of startling to me because I understood that the people that were writing them were from a very different place, and Camus, for example, in Algeria, and I learned just a little bit about France and Algeria's history. And so philosophy for me, when I first started reading some texts, I was also aware of the sort of social setting mm-hmm. and the startling quality that you can experience as a reader from when someone communicates mm-hmm. so clearly and intensely from a different social situation.
Yeah. And when you went to college, did you have a clear trajectory, or were you, sampling a lot of different subjects to see what you might want to study and what you might want to do? Or did you have ideas going in about what your career should be, or parental pressures, or what was your mindset going into school?
I was fortunate to have an academic scholarship. And so when I went, I went in undecided, sort of officially undecided, and I took some intro to philosophy courses, I took some creative writing courses, I took Spanish and Latin, I took some like great books classes so that I could continue reading, the canon, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And out of that, I thought the most interesting thing to do would be to actually teach philosophy at the time. That was what my mindset was. And certainly there was some parental pressure. I mean, when I told my mother and father that I wanted to study philosophy, typically exactly what you might expect happened. And it was like, why not study business, or why not study economics or something? And in hindsight, that might have been a great idea. Maybe I should have taken their advice, but it's difficult to second guess, and when you're an 18-year-old and you're really convinced that you're doing the right thing.
And you're certain, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so, I definitely caught the bug and tried to immerse myself in philosophy texts and literature and try to learn how to write well. And so my first few years in college were really devoted to those things.
Mm-hmm. So the interest in philosophy became more acute in college. What led your interest to deepen? Anything in particular, or was it just a gradual, emergence?
Yeah, so I got into the Honors College at Ohio University, which was based on an old format that was started in Oxford and Cambridge, from what I understand, an independent study curriculum. So the benefit of that was I got to go into this program and I didn't have to go to many other classes. I was able to, say, for example, take a modern philosophy course that starts by reading Descartes and just spend 3 weeks just reading Descartes.
Mm-hmm.
And so what really got me a chance to deepen my interest in philosophy was being able to take time and just not have anything else to do, that was required of me, but to read these texts deeply and then to communicate sort of one-on-one with a professor mm-hmm. about, how I felt about the text, how I perceived it. And then the professor could give me a sense of what other scholars had said and what the sort of tradition of interpreting this text was.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was the getting into that honors college, the tutorial college at Ohio University, was really the trigger point for a deeper immersion.
Got it. And how did you end up at ASU? Because you started at school in Ohio and then you graduated. You got your degree from ASU, is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. So my first 2 years were at Ohio University, and I had a family member. My sister was living in Arizona at the time, and she had gone to the University of Arizona. And from the time that I was, 12 years old, it was sort of, there was always this option of being able to go out to Arizona someday. And so I applied to Arizona State University's Honors College in their philosophy program, and I got accepted and then had to spend a few weeks trying to convince my parents to let me move out to Arizona and
to continue studying philosophy, of all things.
Yes, right? Exactly right. And so I did it. I went out to Tempe, Arizona, and I was there for the next 2 years. And the format at Arizona State University was quite different from Ohio University. Rather than a honors tutorial college with an independent study curriculum, Arizona State was very much, you're sitting in a classroom with 15 or 20 other people, mm-hmm. and you have your set readings, and it's some of them were workshop seminar formats, but several of the classes were much more sort of what we typically think of as a college classroom type mm-hmm. environment.
In terms of your time studying philosophy, what do you think are some of the common misconceptions about philosophy that, mm-hmm. might, for instance, lead people like your parents or the average college student's parents to, say, oh, that's a terrible idea to study that?
Yeah, well, one is when your job is to think of concepts and analyze concepts, which is one way of looking at philosophy as sort of conceptual analysis,
mm-hmm.
it's easy to make distinctions that don't actually make a difference. And, you can get the impression in a lot of people that philosophy sort of over-conceptualizes some things. And when it comes down to sort of practical life and human affairs and, socially embedded human relationships, sometimes
yeah.
that lone philosopher mentality can be a barrier. And I think one of the misconceptions is that lone philosopher is what philosophy is about.
Yeah.
And I disagree with that. I think that the lone philosopher is a kind of archetype or motif that is very common in the history of philosophy and probably in contemporary philosophy as well. But as far as the value of philosophy education, I don't think it's just training people to become lone philosophers. It's much more of an engaged process, or it can be,
yeah,
and probably should be.
Yeah, well, I think the way that philosophy, or at least Western philosophy, originates is through actual conversations, right? On
exactly.
In public between Socrates and actual people, not the not Rodin's thinker, right?
Right.
Just pontificating.
Yeah.
And I think that criticism is in some ways well placed because let's face it, there is a lot of philosophy, I think, done in the academy that is this, sort of splitting of split hairs, distinctions that don't make a difference, as you put it. But one thing that is interesting and encouraging to me is meeting folks like yourself who have, much, if not most, of their education was in philosophy, but they have found ways to, apply their minds two very, you know, concrete problems in practical settings, which we can get to in a little bit more. You had mentioned a favorite philosopher that you had sent me a photo of that I'll be putting up on the page for your episode, who I had never heard of before, Bernard Barofsky. Who is he and why is he your favorite philosopher?
So Bernard Barofsky is a professor at Columbia University, philosophy professor, who's been writing about free will and topics surrounding the sort of metaphysical questions about free will since the 1950s. And he's been, over time, developing a skill. His writing is beautiful and precise and sympathetic to his opponents in a way that I really value. And I came across his work just by roaming the stacks at the library, which was something that I used to just do for fun. I spent, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours in the library just walking around, not knowing what I was looking for, and looking at titles on the bookshelf and picking up things that seemed interesting. And I picked up Barofsky's book called Liberation from Self, A Theory of Personal Autonomy, which was written in... I think published in 1995 or 96.
Okay.
And
so is he still alive and working?
I believe so. Yes. His most recent book was from 2012. So I hope he's still around. But and so yeah, I read that book and it was way over my head, but something was really intriguing about it, and so I kept trying to go back to it periodically and reread it. And he's been somebody that I've found a lot of inspiration from his precision and his range, his ability to communicate the sort of key details of the debate around free will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I don't know anything about his philosophy, but just the title of the book you mentioned, it sounds very Buddhist. And I know you had mentioned that Buddhist philosophy was one of your main areas of interest. Is his work influenced by Buddhism, or is it just sort of run parallel to that?
I think he may have been conscious of the connotation of the title being Liberation from Self. I know in ethical theory, like Derek Parfit famously at the end of Reasons and Persons gives like a sort of appendix that has a sort of Buddhist texts in the back of it. So there is a rich tradition of Western philosophy sort of engaging with Buddhism. But in Barofsky's case, what he means by liberation from self is that what characterizes autonomous relationship with the, autonomous decision making is really an interaction between the individual and the environment.
Okay.
And so he wants to move, he wants to sort of criticize a particular view of autonomy that tends to maybe essentialize the subject, and sort of like a Kantian tradition where the subjective entity that then is the, you know, the reason faculty of that entity organizes the will. And for Barofsky, the autonomy is primarily characterized by not just what are called the positive freedoms of, you know, emotional stability and certain reasoning abilities and et cetera, but it's also an engagement with the world and an openness to the world. So when he says liberation from self, it's more of a trying to make a point about that deep engagement with the environment. But I to answer your question about the Buddhist philosophy, when I finished my undergraduate degree, I realized that I hadn't really encountered other philosophical traditions, but I did have some religious studies professors that I had taken classes with while I was in college, and so I started sending emails to some of these professors that I had had, saying, for example, there was one professor at Ohio University named Justin McDaniel, who is now at UC Riverside, a religious studies professor, and I got a lot of really good advice from him when I was in college. And so when I finished school, I wrote him an email and said, he was a Theravadan Buddhist monk when he was like 18, 19 years old, and he went to Thailand for a year before he went to Harvard University.
He did the whole thing, okay, yeah.
Yeah, and sort of immersed himself in and did the sort of monk circuit over there in Thailand. and then I wrote him an email and said, I'm interested in learning more about Buddhist tradition and Buddhist philosophy. And he said, well, you're living in Arizona, there's several competent teachers that are there, so just go someplace. So I started reading and meeting teachers in the Arizona area, and then as time went on, I just started reading on my own and having conversations with friends about ideas that I encountered in Buddhist philosophy, and it's still something that I try to deeply engage with, or well, maybe not so deeply in the last year or two, but
life gets in the way.
True statement.
Yeah. No, I just want to briefly mention, I mean, Buddhism is very much where I feel pulled existentially, and I feel the tension as well, wanting to really immerse myself, not just in terms of philosophically, in terms of study, you know, which I've done to some extent, but more practically in terms of meditation, and you know, I've been on some retreats and so on, but it's hard. You know, balancing that with, you know, being in your 30s and trying to, you know, launch a career.
And there's definitely some overlap between when I started reading Buddhist texts, I realized that, you know, this is, if you're into philosophy, like technical philosophy, where people are making distinctions and doing deep analytic thought about analyzing concepts and the implications of concepts and the sort of logical interactions of concepts, Buddhist tradition has a vast reservoir of unique insights that, you know, the Dalai Lama's version of Buddhism, the Gelugpa tradition, is very sort of analytic and almost like Aristotelian in its precision with concepts. Mm-hmm. So there, I found a lot of overlap between the analytic training that I received at Arizona State and reading Buddhist texts and sort of being floored by the insights.
Yeah. Well, I think I think there is a very rapidly growing appreciation for that overlap that I think wasn't there, you know, maybe a decade or two ago. I know you had mentioned the University of Hawaii philosophy program was a place that you considered the place to be. As I did when I was in graduate school at Fordham, I wished halfway through that I had applied to that program. I didn't know about it until I was already, you know, in the middle of a PhD. But I was at a conference there around 2007, and one of the professors there said that John Searle, philosopher of language, had come for one of their keynotes for one of their big East-West conferences they have every 4 years, 5 years. And he had said quietly to a number of his hosts, I can't imagine anything more rude than this. Well, you know, let's just get something straight. There really is no such thing as Eastern philosophy.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, so the level of ignorance and almost like Western chauvinism, you might say, that is present, has been present, I think, is fortunately dissipating. But yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of overlap there.
Yeah, I was... convinced that, so I lived in Hawaii for a couple of years actually when I finished college, and I was living on the island of Kauai, and I learned about the University of Hawaii's comparative philosophy program, and I really wanted to apply, and so I started the application, I wrote the entrance essay, and all I needed was the letters of recommendation, and I had at that point been out of school for 4 years, I believe, and so when I sent the emails to my former professors at Arizona State and Ohio University asking for letters of recommendation, I wasn't able to get all three letters of recommendation that I needed. I was able to get one, and then the other two professors said, well, I know what your grade was. You got a good grade, but I don't actually remember you specifically. And so it would be great if you could come and have a conversation with me if you really want to get this letter of recommendation. So I flew...
Wow.
From Hawaii back to Arizona, where some of my family was living at the time.
Okay.
And partly with the intent of going and meeting these former professors to get these letters of recommendation so that I could get into the University of Hawaii. And while I was in Arizona, I learned about a science and technology policy program that was at Arizona State University.
Okay.
And I started thinking that it was a sort of crisis moment for me where the kind of fork in the road. Yep. And I guess maybe my priorities and had changed slightly. And I also thought that there's definitely overlap between philosophy and, you know, public policy and scienceology and the issues, the social and ethical implications of science and technology. And so I decided to stay in Arizona and apply to this science and technology policy program. So it was in another life, I would have gone to the University of Hawaii, and I'm sure that would have been wonderful, but that's not how it happened.
Got it. So that was a big turning point. It's sort of, am I going to stay outside the cave in the Isles of the Blessed or go back in and apply the wisdom that I've learned studying philosophy? I actually want to, before we shift to your shift to public policy, you had mentioned that you worked on Tropic Thunder while you were in Hawaii. Could you briefly tell us about how you got involved with that?
So, yeah, I'm sure many of your listeners will have seen this zany and outrageous film directed by Ben Stiller called Tropic Thunder. I was I went to Hawaii originally on a vacation, and while I was there, I was at a fish taco stand on the island of Kauai, and I saw a group of people sitting outside and having lunch, and they were clearly part of some thing that they were doing, and there was some video equipment, and there were people with clipboards probably like planning the the next day's shooting or something like that. And so I was 23, 24 years old, and just walked up and said, what are you guys doing? And they said, we're making a film. And I said, I've always wanted to learn about how film is made. Are there jobs available? Do you need extras and things like that? Mm-hmm. And they said, yeah, we need lots of extras. Just go down the road, and at this hotel, there's a place, there's a little trailer out front, and they'll take your photo, and you can be an extra in Tropic Thunder. And so I did that, and I was an extra in one of the scenes. And then the story gets deeper. It turns out I started living at a vacation rental that a friend of mine was renting, and we rented out the master bedroom at this vacation rental place. And who should rent the master bedroom but Ben Stiller's chauffeur? Ben Stiller's driver rented the master bedroom at the place that I was living, and he got me a job as a production assistant so on the film. So for the last month of the shooting on the island of Kauai in 2007, I was working on the film by day as a production assistant, and then by night talking with Ben Stiller's driver about the day's events and the script and how weird it was. And that's Tropic Thunder. Now, in the final cut of the film, the scene that I was an extra in is not in the final cut. It's in the director's cut, or the extended cut, and you can only see like the back portion of my head in like the bottom right corner of the screen. And so what I thought was going to be my silver screen debut turned out to be almost an invisible role.
Yeah. Well, there's still time. So there's one more sort of random story that you mentioned that I have to bring up. You mentioned that you attended an event at the Integral Institute. And I'm guessing that was around this time. I think you said it was 2005. Is that right?
Yeah, in 2005.
Yeah, we don't have enough time to dive into integral philosophy. Some listeners might be familiar with it, but I'm very jealous, and I'm very curious to hear how you ended up there. Just as a side note, I've been following Ken Wilber's work, his integral philosophy, since I was 19, and it's still pretty much, I think, pretty much friggin' right. Mm. It's pretty much my operative way of seeing the world. So I'd love to hear how you ended up there. If you want to give listeners a brief, overview of what it is.
Sure. Yeah. So, when I was actually in high school, a friend of mine went to a Borders Books and Music. They used to have this thing called Borders Books and Music. I think they're pretty much defunct now, but it was a bookstore.
Yeah.
And we were just walking around the Borders Books and Music looking at the shelves, and I found a book by Ken Wilber called Sex Ecology Spirituality.
Yep.
And Ken Wilber is he went to Duke University to study chemistry, I believe, and then he became disillusioned and got very interested in transpersonal psychology and started writing books. And over time developed a framework that tries to integrate all of the great sort of perspectives and sciences and philosophies into a coherent sort of system. So the sort of phenomenological traditions, the religious traditions, the third person scientific descriptive traditions, the first person plural traditions about community and social organization, and weaves it together into some fascinating books. And so I read a little bit of his work when I was in my late last year of high school and knew about him. But then a few years later, there was an opportunity to go to this thing. It was in Petaluma, California, at the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Mm-hmm. And it was a integral institute, Ken Wilber's organization. And they were doing this thing called an integral transformative practice seminar. It was, three to 5 days. I can't remember exactly what it was. And they were offering partial scholarships to it. And at the time, I had just finished college, and I was pretty broke. And so they gave me a partial scholarship. So I went up there to Petaluma, California. When I got there, I couldn't sleep the first night that I got there. It was impossible to sleep for me for whatever reason. I was very excited about the whole thing. And so I left the place that, the dormitory area, and I walked up a hill in Petaluma, California. Is absolutely gorgeous, by the way, like green rolling hills and very fresh air. And so I went up to this little cottage that they have where it's sort of like a waiting area or an entrance area when you get onto the property there. And I was sitting there at like 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and a car pulled up, and two men got out of the car, and they were looking for the dormitory. And so I was giving them directions, and they said, I went with them in the vehicle, and you had to drive up a little ways to get to the dormitory. We started talking, and it turned out that the gentleman that was driving the car grew up in Rocky River, Ohio, which is literally right next to Olmsted Falls, Ohio, which where I grew up. Uh-huh. Out of the whole planet, the person that's sitting in this car is from the town right next to me. Mm-hmm. And the other person that was in the car was a gentleman named Stanley Jordan, who is one of the world's greatest guitarists. And he's also an innovator in integral music therapy, integral music theory. So I met this guitarist, and over the next 3 to 5 days, not only were we interacting with all kinds of very interesting people, but at night we would just listen to Stanley Jordan play improvisational jazz music on the guitar. And it still sticks out in my mind as it was a very extraordinary, beautiful experience. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, another time we can rap more about Integral, but I just wanted to hear your story, how that came about. Pivoting back to your own pivot to public policy. So you did a professional master's in science and technology policy at ASU. And what was that transition like, moving from more sort of, pure philosophy, so to speak, to a more applied context in a policy setting? And what was it about that, made you take that fork in the road?
So the program at Arizona State was started by the Arizona State University's president, Michael Crow, who was a professor of science and technology policy at Iowa State University and Columbia University. And he and some of his friends and colleagues started a consortium called the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes. At Columbia University, and then transferred it to Arizona State when Michael Crow became president of the university. And it turns out that the people that run the consortium, the director and co-director, are sort of philosophically minded people. And one of them, Daniel Sarowitz, when I entered the program and took his seminar called Uncertainty and Decision Making. It turns out that the first readings that we did were like Isaiah Berlin and, philosophically minded people writing about public policy and the difficulties of, for example, legislating consequences of consequences of consequences of human behavior. You know, how do you, when you think about decision making and how you just have swarms of human beings all making decisions, how do you produce legislation that enacts something like responsibility or something like the public benefit or the public good? Mm-hmm. You know, so the program I found actually dealt sort of philosophically with questions of public policy. Mm-hmm. And so for me, the transition was, it was a little bit difficult because I was had to read a lot more sociology and, mm-hmm. and, you know, typical policy analysis, and doing the style of writing was also quite different. Instead of writing philosophy term papers, we were writing one-page policy briefs and long-form policy briefs. Mm-hmm. But many of the ideas, I think, sort of cross over because, for example, in public policy analysis, these days, you know, cost-benefit analysis, for example, is a key technique that many government agencies use. And cost-benefit analysis is sort of has roots in philosophical thinking about how to make decisions. You know,
right, you could imagine utilitarianism.
You can imagine a utilitarian saying, well, you know, if I want to understand as an individual how I should act, maybe I should think through the consequences if I'm a consequentialist, or think through how do I quantify what my values are and give those their due in the decision-making process. Well, in public policy, it's not just one person's decision-making process, it's an organization trying to make a decision and incorporating perspectives of not just the organization and its values, but the embeddedness of that organization in the broader sort of social environment and policy mm-hmm. environment.
So you complete this program, where do you go from there? Was the program sort of designed to place people in government, in NGOs, were there a set of sort of specified routes for people to go into career-wise?
It was a pretty new program when I started. I think I was part of the maybe second or third year of this particular master's degree. Mm-hmm. So the administrators did their best to provide resources for people that were graduating, but there was definitely a lot of uncertainty moving through the final stages of the program and doing the master's thesis. And some of the people in the program went on to roles in energy policy, in mm-hmm. healthcare policy. One of them is at NASA right now. Some at the FAA. So, I mean, they did a good job. In my case, when I finished the master's degree, the administrative office at Arizona State told me about this thing called the Presidential Management Fellowship. I applied to that program and managed to get in. And so that was my entryway into professional life. But there was about a year after I had finished the master's program where I worked for the university in one of its think tanks. So they did a really good job of providing graduates with opportunities within the university, because the Arizona State University is a very dynamic, growing enterprise. It's a $3 billion a year entity. So they're very interested in the interface between science and technology and society and government. And so one of the things that they do is produce new organizations like the Center for Nanotechnology and Society that I worked for that can get a grant.
So that was the think tank that you worked for immediately after the master's?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And in that capacity, my job was, I got involved in laboratory ethnography. So Arizona State University has this consortium for science policy and outcomes in the Center for Nanotechnology and Society have done a lot of conceptual work building new concepts that might be useful for thinking about science and technology and emerging technology specifically. Mm-hmm. And one of those buzzwords or concepts is responsible innovation. Mm-hmm. And so the job that I had was a little piece of this responsible innovation framework. It involves going directly into science laboratories and interviewing the scientists and asking them questions about the work that they're doing, the sort of ethical and social significance of the work that they're doing, mm-hmm. and to work with the scientist on the ground to think about how could you do your work differently. And if you thought about your work from a perspective that you hadn't considered before, say, you know, the local public outside of the research institute, or how your work would be, different ways that you could go about producing innovations, you know, with whether it's patenting or just the everyday work of setting up experiments and evaluating experiments. Mm-hmm. So I went to Japan to the National Institute for Material Science and worked in a laboratory with some material scientists that were basically, they were performing basic material science measurements on biological proteins. Hmm. So thinking about biological proteins as basically like wires or circuits, and seeing what their electrical properties were, what their optical properties were. And so on a daily basis, for 3 months, my job was just to interview these scientists once a day or once a week, whenever they were available, and just be part of the laboratory sort of culture of discovery and communicate with them basically continuously about their decision-making processes to get them to be sort of self-reflective yeah. about their decision-making. And so my philosophy training really did come in handy in that, because it involved clarifying what the distinctions that they were making. You know, if they were describing an experiment to me, mm-hmm. I didn't really understand the science behind it very well. So I had to focus on the conceptual distinctions that they were making,
yeah.
rather than the underlying sort of mathematical framework of it.
Yeah, and that was going to be one of my questions, actually, is what level of, you know, scientific knowledge or expertise would you have in order to be able to ask intelligent questions,
right.
especially with these extremely, you know, technical subjects, nanotechnology. I know you've worked on synthetic biology as well, materials science. So was that a challenge that you had to surmount, or maybe not, it sounds like you're saying?
Well, it is, in the sense that there was a lot of prep work that had to go into it. But for example, I knew the laboratory that I was going into for several months before I got there. And so I was able to download all the research papers that they had produced and basically run through it with a pretty fine-tooth comb, like going through the citations at the end of the paper and then trying mm-hmm. to read a little bit about the work that they were citing to get just a general sense of, you know, most of these scientific papers, they begin with an introduction and then they get into the details of the statistical analysis and the methods section. Mm-hmm. So by reading the introduction and gleaning what I could from it over a period of a few months before I got into the laboratory, I think I had enough of it wasn't quite expertise, but it was a kind of interactional competence that I was able to have. And then over time, they're very forgiving. The scientists were very forgiving about mm-hmm. me not knowing many things, and so they went out of their way to tell me in layman's terms what was going on. And then as time went on, I was able to understand the lingo and develop a kind of, not quite fluency, but something that worked well enough to get the job done.
Sure. Can you think of a particular example in which a question you asked or a distinction you made working with a particular scientist or a particular team, you know, made a difference in terms of the feedback they gave you about how it changed the way they thought about their research?
Yeah, the laboratory that I was working in was finishing a long phase of experimentation. I mean, probably 6 or 8 months of, you know, they were trying to characterize a particular biological protein exhaustively. And they have all this laboratory equipment that they, on this material science campus that they have access to. So for months and months, they were doing experiments on dozens of different kinds of laboratory machines that could measure different properties of these materials. Mm-hmm. And then by the time that I got there, they were trying to write it up. And so I think one of the biggest areas where having someone with a philosophical background or a humanities background was helpful for them was how are you going to approach the writing of this paper now that you've got mountains of data and you have to figure out how do I put it in a few pages and who's the audience going to be, and you know, how might people react differently if we structure the paper differently? And then what metaphors are you going to use? Are you going to make analogies in order to connect with the audience? How do you choose an analogy for something like this? And so we were able to have a lot of free-floating sort of discussions about not just sort of knowledge production, but then the circulation of that knowledge. Mm-hmm. How is this knowledge that you produced in this laboratory, how do you want it to circulate in the scientific community? And so the reports that I got back were that my conversations were often helpful. Sometimes they were very irritated with me for asking the same kind of question over and over again, because I had to use a sort of semi-structured interview format for some of the interviews. So sometimes I would walk into the office and they'd say, oh no, get him out of here. Especially when they had an unsuccessful experiment, when if they did an experiment and they didn't get like good clean data and they were wondering if there was something like some knob that they needed to turn in a certain way on the machine that gave a step that they had missed in the experimental process, they really did not want to be talking to somebody like me at that moment, because they're so immersed in the sort of pain of having done all this preparation for one experiment and then something goes wrong. And then somebody's like, well, now I'd like you to reflect on the social and ethical dimensions of this pain that you're experiencing. And they're like,
how do you feel about this pain?
Right.
I guess one of my conclusions, looking over some of the work that you've done, some of the reports and articles that you sent me, you've worked on such a diverse array of issues and emerging technologies, is a common thread in terms of skills you developed or what you're trying to do is better science communication for, you know, kind of have scientists better communicate the work they're doing to non-experts and to the public, so that both it can be made intelligible, but also connected with these larger social and ethical consequences and implications. Is that kind of a fair characterization of what you see yourself as doing?
Yeah, that's definitely a key piece of it, is when scientists communicate to non-scientists, whether it's government officials or regulatory agencies or civil society groups that have a stake in the outcome of the science or the conduct of the science, how do they communicate? How do they choose to communicate? And there are different styles that you find, and some of them are more problematic than others. There are some problematic ways about communicating science to, you know, the public that have good reasons for why it becomes such a go-to sort of discourse for communicating science. You know, the expertise is an undeniable value, but then how does that expertise interact with the broader sort of social constellation where those are the kind of questions that I've been involved with and continue to be involved with.
Yeah. Have you read or heard of the book by Tom Nichols, The Death of Expertise?
No, actually. What should I know about it?
Well, it was just published, I think, late last year. But the thesis was essentially that it was about the erosion of the public's faith in expertise, in, you know, scientific expertise and government expertise, in, you know, the effectiveness of federal agencies, and so on. And how and why that is a threat to a well-governed society. It just struck me as something that might be up your alley, given your interest in, you know, communicating, translating what experts do for a broader audience.
To do really good science, but to also have, you know, preferences about public policy, for public policy. Should they be transparent about their own sensibilities, and can they interact with people like government officials or regulatory agencies in a way that allows their expertise to be valued, but also allows their, you know, sense of what might be the best public policy to also be communicated. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty is that those two things can get mixed up, where the presentation of your political preference is draped in the discourse of expertise, and there's a fuzzy boundary there that needs to be sort of demarcated in each situation and in each context. And that's why I think it's expertise is a kind of inherently contested concept.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, one of the issues that I do a lot of work on is climate change ethics and policy. So it's an issue that comes up all the time. You have sometimes the political views of the scientists, which often tend to be liberal or progressive, that, you know, arguably maybe, you know, seep into the way they present the science in terms of transitioning to the policy realm, which is a normative realm, not just an empirical or conceptual realm. So the Presidential Management Fellowship, you mentioned this was kind of your on-ramp to where you ended up today. Could you say a little bit more about that? What sorts of people are qualified to apply for that? And what sorts of positions do people tend to go in if they are awarded it?
Yeah, so the Presidential Management Fellowship is a program run by the Office of Personnel Management of the federal government. And anyone who has finished a master's degree or a PhD or a Juris Doctorate in the last 2 years is eligible to apply for the program. And the point of the program is it's a leadership development, you know, sort of management tool where you take a bunch of applications, you take about 500 people every year, and you open them up to job opportunities in each of the mission agencies. So everything from the U.S. Department of Agriculture to NASA to the Department of Defense, anything in the executive branch, underneath the executive office of the president, and so they take the applications every year. They probably, I think, between 7,000 and 10,000 applications in a given year, and then you send in some essays. They ask you questions about your motivation for a public service and your background, and then they ask you some questions about how you would interpret certain kinds of workplace environments and situations, a sort of behavioral questionnaire kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then at the time when I took entered the program, they would take the initial applicants and choose about 1,000 semi-finalists, and then they would fly you out to Washington, D.C. for a whole day of interviews and kind of role-playing, scenario planning kind of exercises, and where some public officials are just sort of observing you interacting with other semi-finalists, and then they select finalists, and you. When you become a finalist in the Presidential Management Fellowship Program, they give you access to like a job portal, and all of the agencies can post new job postings on that. And it's a 2-year program. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that you may enter with one agency, like in my case, the Department of Defense, but over the course of the 2 years, you get to do developmental assignments in several different places within the organization or even outside of the organization in mm-hmm. a different agency. So in my case, I entered in the logistics directorate of the Army, and then I did my developmental assignment at the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Research and Engineering, the Defense Laboratories Office specifically, that works on laboratory management policy. Mm-hmm. So because I had a background in science and technology policy, and because I had worked in laboratories before, I was interested in laboratory management. Right. And I just, the great thing about the fellowship as I experienced it was I was able to tell my boss in the logistics directorate, you know, here's my background, here's what I'm really interested in. And he said, okay, you know, we'll go and try to get you some experience in that area. So I was very fortunate that I had a boss who was a former fellow himself. So the boss that I had understood that this is a sort of leadership development training, and rather than just cling on to the fellow and say, no, you're going to stay in this office forever and we're never going to let you leave, they allowed me to, they were sort of receptive to my interests and allowed me to find a place doing that. So that's how I was able to get a job working on research and development budgets.
Mm-hmm. And working in the Pentagon, is that something that you ever pictured yourself doing, or was that something was that one of the things you were aiming at when you were, you know, starting this whole process, or Did it just end up that way?
Well, I mean, the actual how I got the interview was almost completely just sort of out of the blue. No, I hadn't anticipated it. I just got an email one day. I had posted my resume all over the place on the fellowship job portal site and had sent it to all of my friends and old professors trying to drum up some kind of support. And then I got the interview out of the blue. But so no, growing up or while I was studying philosophy or after college and going into the master's degree program, I hadn't really thought that the Department of Defense would be something that I would end up participating in. But at the same time, I had thought about how sort of central the Department of Defense is in these bigger sort of dynamics, sort of world, when you, for example, you're mentioning climate change and climate policy. Mm-hmm. The defense energy system is elaborate and extensive and has, you know, if they change the way that they procure energy, the whole, you know, it's a game, decisions like that are game changers because
ripple effects,
of because of the magnitude of the impacts that this organization has on things like energy supply chains. Mm-hmm. So when I started thinking, when the job opportunity came up and I started thinking about it, I was fascinated by, it's the biggest organization in the world. And so it lends itself to philosophical analysis, I would say. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting place to work.
Yeah. Yeah, well, my next question has to do with the extent to which the work you do on a daily basis is philosophical in nature. Some of what you mentioned at the beginning of our interview, you said you did a financial management analysis was part of your job description, which, you know, somebody might say that sounds a far cry from philosophy. And looking over some of your appointments, you know, since you started there, at least on paper, it seems, you know, worlds apart from you know, the formal study of philosophy. So could you give listeners a sense for how and to what extent your philosophical training is relevant in the work you do on a daily basis at the Department of Defense?
I would say the biggest difference is that rather than lingering on really fundamental normative, epistemological, metaphysical issues, mm-hmm. the daily routine at the Department of Defense in my job is much more sort of instrumentalist. It's practical decisions about how to get things done quickly and accurately and effectively. And so I would say that the big normative questions and the, like, you know, won't come until if I stayed in the organization much later. I you know, it's sort of a just getting your feet wet and learning about the decision making processes is what tends to happen on a daily basis. But the philosophical dimension of it that is there is, you know, just learning the structures. If you're looking at a text, for example, and studying philosophy, you want to know how do the basic concepts of this philosopher interact, and what sort of work are these concepts doing? Mm-hmm. And if some philosophers are big system builders, so if you're going to read, like, you know, Hegel or something, or Kant or something, you need to try to wrap your head around a very large sort of systemic thing. And so there's something similar to that that goes on working in a big organization. It's like, when I first entered the Army, I was given a book called How the Army Runs. It's this big tome, probably like a 10-pound book that with all of, you know, 1,000 pages of just how the Army works. And mm-hmm. so, I mean, if you thought that Hegel was full of, you know, distinctions and things, I mean, the interlocking organizational and decision-making structures in the Army, even though they're built around sort of principles, like, for example, planning, programming, budgeting, and execution. Those are the big sort of budget concepts. And so, but there are these elaborate internal processes that go on in order to produce this end product, which is the budget that goes to Congress. So I think that there is something philosophical about that, about understanding interacting structures.
That architecture, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. I'm curious, what were some of the new skills that you had to learn, either, you know, on the job or while you were preparing for this job in your various, you know, appointments at think tanks or during the fellows program that, you know, you wouldn't have picked up with on through your formal philosophical training?
Yeah. The biggest things for me were mathematical relationships and statistics and probability theory. And so when I got into the Army and started working on financial management, some of the people that are working on financial management in the Army are sort of applied mathematicians, operations researchers, and people that work on everything from combat modeling to just detailed analysis of historical trends in the budget. So when I got into the Army, they said it would help if you had more of a mathematical background.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sent me to Operations Research School at the Army Logistics University in Fort Lee, Virginia.
Okay.
And so I got the, it's like a boot camp for applied mathematicians in the Army. And so I went to this ORSA school and learned, you know, 40 hours a week inside a classroom learning probability theory and basic statistics and calculus and decision theory. And so those
all
are...
All the fun stuff?
Yeah. And, you know, there is a strand of philosophy, a sort of robust strand that takes mathematics really very seriously.
Sure.
And so I just happened to not be in that kind of a philosophy department when I was going to school. So some philosophy students would have been... had an easier transition at the job that I got into compared to what I had.
Mm-hmm. Any other skills that were necessary but that you didn't have coming in or that you, you know, acquired over time?
On a daily basis, the interacting with knowing how to use like Microsoft Excel, for example, just becomes this practical necessity when you're in this organization. And it was something that I had not really been exposed to prior to that. And when I worked at the Center for Nanotechnology and Society, there were a group of skills that I didn't have that about not just interviewing people, but then after the interview is over, like coding the interview so that you can make use of the information easier at a later date was a skill that I really didn't have at the time. So I was trying to learn on my feet while I was working about how do I collect these interviews and then how do I store the information in a way that categorizes it so that it's useful in the future. When I was in getting a degree in philosophy, that really wasn't an urgent kind of skill to have developed. So
right.
Those are a couple examples.
Great. What advice would you have for somebody who might have majored in philosophy, or maybe they did a master's in philosophy, or maybe they're doing a PhD in philosophy, or maybe they finished a PhD in philosophy, who is transitioning out of academia in general, and or wants to break into your line of work in particular?
Well, as far as getting job opportunities, if you want to just sort of put yourself out there and see what happens, the Presidential Management Fellowship that we already mentioned, and for those that have a PhD, the AAAS Fellowship, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, has a really great program for placing PhD holders that have just finished their PhD in the last few years in government agencies, in Congress, in all over the federal government. The gentleman that we spoke about earlier, Dan Sarowitz, who is the co-director of a think tank at Arizona State, he was a geology PhD that decided to get involved in public policy and went through the AAAS fellowship and found himself, you know, 1 year he was in Kazakhstan or the Philippines doing geological research, and the next year he's writing legislation for the head of the House Science Committee. So I would say, you know, one pathway into public policy specifically is to go through one of those established fellowship networks. And also just if you have good relationships with your professors and colleagues and you let them know what you're thinking, people are strange. They have lots of a vast reservoir of experiences, and somebody may know something and be able to help you out. So if I might, I guess my best advice would just be, if you're thinking about doing something slightly different with your career, let people know about it rather than just thinking about it.
Yeah.
Because things can happen.
Yeah. I think that's such great advice, you know, because I mean, the most important network we have is the one that we already have, right?
Right.
People around us, you never know what opportunities are just there dormant at your feet. So just a few kind of wrap-up questions, sort of a little less serious, a little less professionally oriented. Are there any books that you reread every year or that you keep coming back to that are sort of, you know, spiritual guides for you?
There are, actually. So Dune by Frank Herbert, like one of the greatest science fiction novel of all time.
I'm looking at it right on my shelf right now, actually.
No kidding.
I haven't read it yet, but it's on my list for the summer.
Good. So I just read it for the first time 2 years ago, and I was so impressed and mystified by the author's ability to weave environmental philosophy and political theory and sort of the sci-fi sort of world creation and so many different elements into a wonderful story. Mm-hmm. So I'm on my third reading of Dune now, and that's one big one. The Bernard Borofsky book, the Liberation from Self book, I go back to every so often and reread. A book called The Six Perfections, Buddhism and the Cultivation of Character by a professor at Occidental College in California named Dale S. Wright.
Oh yeah, I've read his stuff before.
Yeah.
I haven't read that book, but yeah, I'm familiar with him.
That book is fantastic. It's a scholarly sort of introduction to the tradition, a Buddhist tradition of thinking about the cultivation of character, and then an infusion, a kind of critique of the tradition in light of contemporary understandings and social circumstances, so he's trying to perform a constructive function while still maintaining the academic integrity of someone that's introducing you to a tradition. Mm-hmm. So those three are the first ones that come to my mind that I really do go back to and reread. There's another one. There's a book on the great Jewish philosopher Moses Maimonides that mm-hmm. I reread over and over again by an author named Joel Kramer. Mm-hmm. It's called Maimonides, The Life and Times of One of the World's Greatest Thinkers, or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I've read that one four times, I believe. And so I just get fixated on certain texts, I think. It wasn't until the last few years that I really started rereading things. I always mm-hmm. would just sort of zoom through books and maybe not give them the full credit or immersion that they deserve. And so I'm glad that I've started to develop a habit of going back and rereading things.
Yeah, I like the idea of us all having our own, you know, personal Bibles, whether those are the Bibles or not, you know, something that's like bedrock for us, that's foundational, that like kind of like recenters us.
Exactly. Yeah. One a professor of mine at Arizona State, Norbert Samuelson, he's a Jewish philosophy professor. He told me about a concept of Alfred North Whitehead's called subjective inheritance. Mm-hmm. Each of us has our own subjective inheritance. The unique text that we've read, the people that we've met, the circumstances that we've been in. And it's that subjective inheritance that, you know, is one of the sources of our creativity.
Hmm. Yeah. Karma. Our karma.
Sure.
If you like, maybe. In terms of more specifically, are there books on practical philosophy or public philosophy or, you know, public policy-oriented philosophy you found particularly helpful?
That's a really interesting question. The books that I tend to find are emphasize the public policy but have a philosophical view about them. Like, for example, Dan Sarewitz, the Arizona State professor, wrote a book in 1996 called Frontiers of Illusion. Mm. It's probably the single best introduction to science and technology policy in the United States that I know of. And I've heard others say the same thing about it. And mm-hmm. it begins from a kind of philosophical point of view, in the sense of The opening passage of the book is describing a congressional committee hearing where they were trying to figure out whether the government was going to fund a massive particle accelerator, and it was going to cost a few billion dollars. And one of the congressional leaders posed a question to the top scientist, and he said, "Will this project get us any closer to understanding the mind of God?" And the scientist said, "No, Congressman, it won't." And they cut the funding. They didn't fund the project. Sarowitz, his book begins with this kind of bizarre, in some way, but also almost endearing and quirky moment in U.S. history, when something like the future of physics research actually hinges, in some sense, on a philosophical and a spiritual question that comes from a senator or a congressman and his constituents. You know, and that text is a really sort of magisterial survey of many of the key questions about public policy and the public benefit and the sort of social and ethical dimensions of public policy, specifically related to science and technology funding.
Perfect. It sounds great. Do you have any creativity rituals?
Yeah, well, you know what? So for me, playing baseball and preparing to play baseball is a kind of creativity ritual, and exercise in general is a kind of creativity ritual for me. I think that one of the easiest ways to open up the mind is to go through the body.
Yeah.
And so for me, exercise, sit-ups and push-ups and going for a jog is a kind of creativity ritual. And I find that when I return home and sit down to read a book, I'm able to focus a little bit better and understand, make connections with the text in a way that I otherwise wouldn't. So that's what comes to mind at first about creativity rituals. I'm sure I do a lot of quirky things that I am just so habituated to that I don't even think about mentioning them right now. But
do you know your Myers-Briggs profile?
That's an interesting question. So I've taken the Myers-Briggs test twice, and it was both times it was in a professional setting. The first time I took it, I got an INTJ.
Yes, and that's the philosopher's. That is the philosopher's profile.
No kidding.
That's mine. Yeah.
And so the interesting thing about it, so that when I took that test, I was in a professional development seminar for subordinate employees. So it was like I was just learning how to do some kind of administrative task. Mm-hmm. Then I was sent to a leadership development training, and they gave us the test for a second time, and I scored an ENTJ at mm-hmm. the leadership. So I don't know what that makes me, that I take the same test and get sort of two slight variations. And I don't know if it was that I was adapting to my environment and maybe answering some of the questions in a different way than I... And so it's difficult for me to make the inference from these two cases where I was sort of embedded in the organization, mm-hmm. In an organizational setting and taking the test. I don't know if that tells me what my sort of essence is. I guess there's... No matter when you take the test, you're going to have some sort of influences that might be
right.
Shaping how you answer.
What time of day are you taking it?
Exactly.
What kind
What's
of
your
mood are you in?
Exactly. Exactly.
Did you just get dumped? Yeah. I mean,
right.
There's all sorts of stuff. It's funny you mentioned that. I've taken it multiple times, and my scores are either INTJ or ENTJ. It's the same thing. The I and the I and the E is what I seem to be, you know, pretty evenly split on.
One of my friends is absolutely just enamored of this test and brings it up in all kinds of social settings when we're out and about. And so for you to ask the question, it brings a smile to my face because I hear about this sort of on a continual basis, people making, like observing someone at a bar and saying, I think that's, you know, I think I know that person's type or something. It's,
yeah.
It has a life of its own, this test.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I like to ask it because I think it's just interesting to hear people's own, you know, self-perceptions and if they know, if they've taken the test. But also, I'm interested in patterns among philosophers, and that pattern of INTJ, I've heard that pretty commonly. So it's, you know, it's interesting to see the patterns in terms of, is it a type of personality type that, you know, gravitate towards philosophical thinking and so on. Do you have a favorite superhero?
I heard that you were going to ask this question, and it gave me tremendous anxiety because I was never I don't have a favorite superhero, and I feel the absence of that favorite superhero sort of weighing
on
me.
It's like you were raised without religion or something, yeah?
Right, exactly. No, it's like, can you be a good citizen if you don't have a favorite superhero? I don't know. It's, no, so, but there are qualities of some superheroes that I enjoy, but then most of the superheroes that I know also have some kind of flaw or something like that that makes me not want to fully endorse them. But I also, I think I may have a kind of principled objection to the phenomena of the superhero, because we, on one hand, superheroes are, you know, normal people are not superheroes, and so it's the real sort of Herculean effort from a sort of philosophical point of view is like, how do you take the limitations of being human and make a good life mm-hmm. out of it, rather than, you know, you can spin the world backwards at will. So for me, the sort of the superhuman dimension is I want to sort of ground it in the everyday heroics of just trying to figure out how to think clearly and be compassionate and mm-hmm. And so for people that do that well are kind of superheroes for me.
I always like to see it in you know, metaphorical or maybe even mythological terms. You know, is what is the? I think with a lot of superheroes, it's not exactly their power that they need to effectively channel, but it's some, you know, inner demons they need to conquer in order to effectively, you know, do their thing. So they need to, you know, reckon with their humanity in order to, you know, channel their superpowers. What's next? What are you excited about that you're looking forward to professional-wise?
Yeah, so next year, if I stay in the Department of Defense, they're going to send me to this Syracuse University Defense Comptrollership Program next year. And that involves getting an MBA, Master's in Business Administration, mm-hmm. and an Executive Master's in Public Administration, in 14 months.
Wow.
So that would be... That'd be the next step with the Department of Defense for me. So it would build these competencies in like the kind of business acumen and mm-hmm. Which I think I'm excited about, because it will maybe give me new perspective on these sort of social and ethical questions. How do you think through business operations and business ethics from, you know, I'm interested to see the before and after perspectives on that. So that's one big thing.
Yeah. Make your background even more versatile and eclectic. So that sounds great. Well, Cameron, thank you so much for your time and, you know, sharing your story and your winding path through philosophy to the Pentagon. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure. And good luck to everybody out there listening.
So that wraps my discussion with Cameron and with the ASU Trio, Presidential Management Fellows. If you'd like to check out more about that program, I've posted a link to it in the show notes, as well as a couple other things from my discussion with Cameron. Thanks for listening, and if you have questions, if you have recommendations for guests, please get in touch. You can reach me at www.davidestory.com. And again, if you have an interest in a particular field or industry, you can find the interviews broken down by category, by field, by type on my website. So be sure to check those out. If you're joining the podcast, best thing you can do to help it grow is share it with 5 friends who you think might be interested and write a short review on iTunes. Next week, we'll be taking a different turn with the author of a new book called Ask a Philosopher. which is about exactly what it sounds like. Ian Olesov is a public philosopher at large in Brooklyn. He's been involved with a lot of major public philosophy events in New York City, especially and around the country. His book, Ask a Philosopher, is just coming out this September. So I hope you are staying safe and sane during the pandemic, and I hope to see you back here next week.